Hey everybody, it's George. Before we get started, I want to tell you about Soccer Pro. This is not your typical ad where someone gives us money and we tell you something about them that they tell us to tell you. This is a personal, hearty, personal endorsement, and I'm making it at the chagrin of my little puppy who wants me to go feed her. You might hear her barking in the background. Anyway, Soccer Pro. A couple years ago, Howler had a shipping snafu with Amazon. We used to ship through Amazon's warehouse, which meant that we sent our stuff to them and they would send it out for us when people ordered. It's a long story, but it just like our stock got swallowed up for like 2 months and our readers were upset and understandably, and I was upset, understandably. And what we did instead, Soccer Pro came to our rescue. I had met, someone, I'm not going to go into specifics, but I had met a guy who works there at a soccer game the year before. And I was speaking with him and I said, man, we got this big problem. And he said, you know what, how can we help you? We have a warehouse here in Missouri. We will fulfill your stuff. We'll ship it out for you. It was a godsend. And so now I am so grateful to Soccer Pro, and they've been doing this now for like 2 years, 2.5 years. I gotta say, if you need anything, in the soccer world, gear, jerseys, you know, whatever, shoes, anything, I would personally appreciate it if you would go to soccerpro.com and order there. They have free shipping. They have, you know, from what I've seen, the prices are just as good as anywhere else. And they have a loyalty program that's free. You don't have to like buy into it or anything. And man, it's just, they're just great people. We're in touch with them on a weekly basis. They do this for us. And they don't charge us, like they charge us the shipping, like the postage, but they don't actually charge us to do this. And for a small business like Howler that is just like making ends meet, you know, any way we can, it's just such a huge help. So I want to thank them publicly. I want to thank them personally. I want all of you to go and thank them just by dropping some coin next time you need a new pair of shoes or something. Soccerpro.com, free shipping. Plus I love them and they love Howler. Hello and welcome to Dummy, a weekly conversation among editors and friends of Howler magazine. My name is George Krejci. I'm the editor of Howler. On the other line, the only member of this podcast who has scored a goal in any professional environment that is not a company soccer game, Bobby Warshaw. Hey, Bobby.
Hey, George.
Hey, man. Okay, so we have an interesting show today. You and I are going to talk about this New York Times article by Sam Borden about players who are sent off to train by themselves, which he calls soccer's form of solitary confinement, and I think is very interesting. And you have a personal story about that, which I can't wait to hear. I haven't heard it. I know that it exists. We're going to talk about it. Bobby was sent off to the pastures himself once. Very sad. Sad to think of you that way, Bobby, just by yourself kicking the ball around. But we'll get specifics. Before that, Bobby, you and I are going to talk about, well, we're going to talk about what is wrong with the U.S. Youth soccer development infrastructure. So, you know, industrial complex, I guess. And we have Will Parchman, who's going to join us for that. We published Will's piece in the latest issue. It's called Awakening the Beast, I think. And we just published it online 2 days ago, if you're hearing this the day this comes out. Otherwise, it might have been 3 or 4 days ago or even more. Bobby, finally, you and I are going to have Tiki Taka. We have some things to talk about there. But first, Will Parchman joins us to talk about why we're just not that good. Okay, that's not fair. That's a clickbaity.
Harsh,
that's a
click, man.
That's a clickbaity. That's a
total
that's
clickbait.
Clickbaity.
Right there.
That's a clickbaity thing to say. But we will get there. We'll talk about it all. And I promise you, this is going to be a substantive conversation. Very, very high minded.
This is Howler Radio,
the podcast.
And I'm your host, Matthew Nelson. Howler Radio isn't your average soccer podcast. We don't talk about last weekend's games, we're not interested in tactics, and we don't care how many goals Messi scored or how many abs Ronaldo now has. So, what do? Well, we tell stories. Like in Season 1, when we took an epic journey into the dark heart of Don Garber's least favourite chant. I went to Estadio Azteca to find out what it's like to be an away fan when you're there to support the US.
I was just given an offer to step outside. Guy wants to kill me. I told him 1-0.
In season two, we take you inside the murky world of corruption in football and find out what happens when you mess with the wrong people.
Two guys in a motorcycle actually jumped into me and they put a gun in my head and told me they were going to blow my head off. And they kept on saying that for 700 times.
And I ask Zlatan Ibrahimovic the questions that really matter.
If you were to choose like an animal that represents like the spirit of Zlatan, what would you choose?
I would be a mix from a lion and a hawk.
Why? Explain that choice.
Because I'm strong as Hulk and I'm angry as a lion when he gets angry.
And there's more. We talked to Danish goalkeeper Jimmy Nielsen about the addiction that nearly destroyed his life and take you to the trippy wedding of football's ultimate bad boy, Reading legend Robin Friday.
And it was a hot summer's day, so we were all, it was all outside. They were continuously making a large bowl of punch and everybody was drinking that for a toast and things. But unbeknown to me, that they'd been putting LSD in it, spiking it with LSD, so all my elderly aunts and uncles were like tripping without realising it.
All of these shows and our back catalogue will be available through our iTunes feed. Just search for Howler Radio. You can also find us anywhere else you go in the known universe to listen to podcasts.
Okay, so most people listening to this probably watched the recent U.S. national team game against Guatemala. You probably watched the under-23 home and away series against Colombia. They sort of had opposite beginnings and endings. The one against Colombia started really well and ended just abjectly. The one against Guatemala, the full national team started out just absolutely could not have been worse. A 2-0 loss to Guatemala and ended pretty well, I would say. 4-0 win. We can debate the merits of that win, and we will. But right now we have Will Parchman on the line because Will is the guy we go to when we want to talk about youth soccer development. And in the new issue of Howler, issue 10, Will, you wrote a piece in the magazine called Taming the Beast, Awakening the Beast, because it's got this great illustration of an octopus that represents all the different flailing arms of American youth soccer development. And I want to get into this because, you know, you point out that the Olympic team, that's composed of professional players. These are young men who are playing professionally in, you know, leagues in the U.S. and overseas, but they are buttressed by a very complicated set of building blocks, leagues around the country, teams, clubs, and they are not held together by very much in the way of, I guess, a national glue. And I want to get into all of this. I want to bring Bobby Warshaw in because he is a product of this development system. I guess maybe we all are. I am a product that dropped out at a certain point, and so probably Will, you might be too. But Bobby, you succeeded and you came through it, and I want to get everyone's perspective. But let's start by, Will, give us the lay of the land. What are the different building blocks, the different entities, the different power nodules? Did I use that word right? Anyway, of American youth soccer. What are we looking at here when we talk about the American youth soccer development sort of industrial complex?
Yeah, so now, I mean, if you want to start at the top now, you're talking about the U.S. Soccer Development Academy, which was established in 2007. So, you know, this is about 80 clubs are playing around the world, around the country. And they're all travel clubs. You know, you play regionally, and then it kind of funnels into a summer playoffs and then the Development Academy final. So it's very regimented. And this is where sort of the general perception is anyway, that the best players are, that they're all funneling into these clubs.
So these 80 clubs around the country that would ostensibly collect the best talent and put them on show for pro scouts, national team scouts, things like that.
That's the idea, is that, you know, ideally the U.S. soccer scouting infrastructure would be strong enough that they could identify players. And that just that the organization is ingrained in these cities and these communities enough that you would know that if you want to be the best and you live in the Dallas Metroplex, then you got to go play for FC Dallas. And that has largely held true, but it's easy to forget how big of a country that this is when you live in it. And, you know, you're talking about players in huge geographic swaths of this country that just have no scouting, that they're not being developed by guys who have any real soccer education that know the game. And here we're talking about, you know, a lot of the Midwest states don't really have an MLS club that they've had to look up to.
Well, let's get into that. But first, what after, if you're looking at this like as a pyramid, which is a loaded term, I guess, what comes beneath the U.S. Soccer Development Academy, those 80 teams? What are the other building blocks here?
Yeah, so it's pretty much split between U.S. club soccer and U.S. youth soccer, which are sort of the two major youth soccer organizations in the country. And if you've played soccer in America, you have played in a U.S. youth soccer club. There's I don't even know how many teams they have, but I think they claim like 2 million youth players in this country. So where U.S. soccer can't really pick up the U6, U7, U8 teams just because they don't have the resources, that's where those clubs come into play the most, is you're talking about kids that are 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years old. And so when U.S. soccer gets them, in a lot of ways, their development has already begun and, you know, crucially has gone through some pretty important steps. So when they're 12 and, you know, they start their development academy careers, you know, they've been developed by U.S. youth soccer already, in a sense.
Okay. So well, I want to get into more of these points. I want to throw it to Bobby real quick. And Bobby, I want to use you as kind of a case study. And I apologize, but you know, you grew up playing soccer, youth soccer in Pennsylvania. You played high school soccer. You went to Stanford and played there for 4 years. You were drafted by FC Dallas, and then you went abroad. And so you've played across the spectrum. And I left out the national teams. As a kid, you were scouted and you played for the national teams. I don't know if you came up through ODP or how you did that, but what was the first time you felt like you had been identified by a bigger, better team that came in and swooped in and said, oh, that guy, we want him. He's going to come play for us.
Yeah, I experienced firsthand a lot of what Will is talking about right now. I was a kid from central Pennsylvania, a small town with really no elite clubs. And we have what's called PA Classics. I'm from basically where Christian Pulisic is from. And the club he played for didn't exist 10 years ago when I was coming through. So I remember at 14, I made the decision to go play for the ODP team, which is a 2-hour drive, and a club team, which is a 2-hour drive, just because, A, to challenge myself to see how good I could be, but partially to be identified. I felt like I was a decent player and might have been able to make it farther, but it wasn't an option in central Pennsylvania. I had to go to the bigger pool and prove myself. Even if I was seen in central Pennsylvania, coaches would have doubted whether I could do it against better competition.
So Bobby, you had to go to like tryouts for ODP, pay money, try out, and then
Yeah. Okay. And then I had to drive the 2 hours twice a week, drive to practice. So what Will talks about, this big parts of the country where players are unidentified, I was a part of that. I felt that growing up.
Yeah, and Will, there's a quote from your piece that says if you're a promising youth player in Missoula, Montana, you are more likely to wither on the vine than to be picked for the harvest, which I think is an interesting quote. And it gets to another thing that we're talking about. I think I want to mention to people that, A, we put this piece online by the time you're hearing this yesterday, so on Wednesday, and that was a fortuitous timing because people are talking about this stuff today. But also, your piece is divided, and I should say I edited this piece, so I have a little bit of familiarity with it. We decided to organize it into three parts, right? We identified three things as like very broadly as the things that are ailing American soccer, and those are space, the size of the country. Second one would be, I guess, time, the fact that we haven't really matured in terms of, you know, if you think about the way soil is used, like soil needs to be replenished. And so the soccer version of that is, you know, you have people like Bobby who grow up, play through their careers and then become coaches, and they sort of cultivate the next round. And that has been, that's been a weakness of ours, you know, because we don't have that going back decades and decades and decades the way they do in, say, Italy or Argentina. True. Finally, it's money. We and that's related to the other things, but like in order to catch up in terms of time or to cover that much space, you need to invest. And so those are three areas where we're falling short. I wonder if you want to add anything to that or expand on that at all.
George, if I could hop in right here, because this is one thing I really wanted to talk about, is amongst my peers and the guys that I've played with over the years, the number one thing we identify that's a big crisis with us growing up is who coached us. We had our parents coaching us or somebody else's parent. There were no soccer players coaching their kids. And even as we went into the higher levels of club, higher levels of college and professional, we had non-soccer players coaching us.
Well, that's another – yeah, Bobby, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's another thing – And I think that's related to the time aspect of this. And mm-hmm. I want to just read really quickly, Will, a sentence that's in your piece, and I hope I'm not spoiling this for anybody, but it goes like this. Any real substantive change will be engendered on the ground level with qualified and passionate youth coaches taking U8 and U10 and U14 players through their paces at a high level. This, more than mm-hmm. anything, is what the U.S. lacks when compared with the world's top nations.
I think that, you know, if you look at the coaches, like Bobby was saying, let's say we go to Ajax, you know, their U6, U8 coaches are some of the most prized coaches in their system. They're some of the most educated, and they're going to that level on purpose. I mean, they want to coach these young kids. And I think in America, we kind of view there's a promotional ladder where if you coach U6s, well, you're doing it to eventually coach U18s because that's where the best players are. That's where
you get recognized, and there's more money.
Yeah,
and recognition.
As if we're treating youth soccer like a spectator sport. Like we want to coach the best players because they're the most fun to watch. Whereas, you know, if you look at the more developed soccer countries, they want to send their best coaches, their most educated coaches, down to the youngest levels because that's where a lot of the most substantive technical training takes place, which is funny to think about, but it's true.
Well, you know, it's funny. Like, when I was editing this, the thing that came to mind was my own experience, right? And so, if it's okay, I'm going to bring that in for a minute. But my first youth coach was my dad, right, who played professionally. My second youth coach was Bryce Weggerly's dad, Steve Weggerly, who played professionally. So we in Tampa, we had the former Rowdies, who all, like, not all of them, but so many of them stuck around. Perry Vanderbeck was my coach at one point. He was the captain of the U.S. Olympic team. Like these are. I recognize that I was extraordinarily lucky to play for these people who had this knowledge, but this is the kind of thing that, like, if we're doing it right in 40 years, that kind of sort of system will be replicated in city after city after city. Anywhere there's an MLS or an NASL or hopefully even a USL club, that will be the case. There will be smart people who are coaching kids.
That's exactly right. We just have to get through a cycle or two, get through a generation or two of born and bred soccer players who will then coach their kids and will then take on the next generation.
I saw Eddie Gavin is now the head coach of a Catholic college in Florida now. I mean,
Ave Maria. Yeah,
that might have been one of your tweets actually, or maybe you know, even that is like pretty late in terms of getting to these kids. But like, I want to ask you this: what is the advantage? And Bobby, Will, you guys can both answer this. What is the advantage of having someone that experience coaching at a young level? I mean, shouldn't kids just be playing and learning to love the game at that level, or are they actually going to learn things?
Yeah, I think it's more to do with what you're coaching rather than how you're coaching. Because if you take somebody off the street, like a dad who's just coaching soccer, he's not going to know, you know, sort of about the tenets of a 4-3-3. And that's not to say that you're bringing that stuff on a, you know, A to B basis to young kids. But what you are doing is you're just coaching very general basics of, you know, pass to feet.
Keep your eyes open when you're heading the ball, use your forehead, you know, touch.
Yeah, like then don't just sprint up the field. We want to, you know, stay tethered to our teammates, and we want to stay close to each other, and we want to keep a line. Just very basic tenets that, you know, if you watch youth soccer enough of it, you see a lot of these coaches are just based on, you know, coaching based on athletics and not necessarily technical ability.
Yeah. Bobby, do you remember, like, when you were a kid, what kind of coaching you had?
I have a strong opinion on this. I'm pretty harsh on this, and I'm not particularly sure that I'm right in what I'm about to say, or if I am right, it's even a good thing. But I think that the youth coaches right now just aren't hard enough on the kids. I think the benefit of having a professional player, a former professional player coach your kids is they know what it takes. They know how hard it is. If you want to be good, it takes a million monotonous touches, and it sucks a lot of the time. It is very machine-like. So to have somebody who's done that themselves, they don't mind putting seven-year-old kids in a square and saying up, 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 up hundreds and hundreds of times. And it might not be fun. It might not be cool. But we're not looking for thousands of kids that fun. We're looking for two kids a generation.
It's funny. It's not just that either, right? But it's also – I remember this from when I was a kid. The coach that I went to after Steve – wanted to just put all the biggest kids at defense. And my dad was like, yeah, look, you don't have to be big to play defense. You have to be smart to play defense. You have to know, like, you have to be able to read the game. And that is a huge, you know, but if you're stuck there as a kid, if you're a small kid and you know, how does Michael Parkhurst find out that he's a good defender? If you know, the big kids are always getting to be put at center back, right?
or you put the fastest kid at forward, which is what almost always happens at the youth level. And you go to these development academy showcases, and you see this big, strong, fast kid that they're just lumping it up to, and he's just beating kids one on one. Well, how is that helping him develop mentally? I can name, you know, three or four homegrown kids off the top of my head right now who are in MLS systems who never played to feet out of their youth programs, which is a major, major issue.
And so what are some of the remedies for this? I know you go over this in your piece. I kind of want to give people a taste of that. I would encourage everyone to go read it, but Will, what are some of the fixes for this?
Well, I think the first thing is requiring coaching, coaching licenses at younger ages, because we've done a good job of slowly stepping up the quality, you know, in the places like the Development Academy, but those are for older kids. So I think that, you know, you shouldn't be able to just step into a huge youth organization and just coach with no credentials. You should at least have to take like a weekend course just to get like basic tenets.
You know, that reminds me, in the last issue, Will, I don't know if you read the piece we did about Iceland and how their national team has sort of gone from like 130 something to like top 25. But one of the things they did was make a concerted effort to recruit like qualified coaches who got their UEFA badges. And by the end, they had like some multiple more than even in England, which is, you know, by that number,
bad
far
comparison
ahead of the US.
Bad bar to reach, but another question.
And so I think it needs to start with the coaches, because I think, you know, as much as we've focused on players in the last 10 or 15 years, I think the switch to talking about coaching education is important. But I think I'm also a firm believer, and I'm passionate about our scouting network in this country, because I think it's really, really poor. This goes back decades. I mean, this is just from not having ingrained presences in major soccer communities and then having that sort of flare out to the surrounding region. And we just don't have much of a presence at all in this country. I mean, you're talking about U.S. soccer employs 10 full-time, I think they call them, technical scouts, these guys that go out and canvas full-time. They've got like 100 other that are on the payroll part-time. And you can't expect to sort of unearth these main talents just relying on coaching recommendations.
And are we talking what ages are we talking about these scouts starting to look at kids, Will?
I mean, most of them are scouting Development Academy games. They're going to U.S. Youth Soccer National Championships. So, I mean, we're talking starting at around 13 or 14 years old. But we need,
Messi had been with Barcelona how many years by the time he was 14?
Well, he had moved. I think he moved to Barcelona when he was 13. But he had been in Rosario, I believe, since he was like six.
Okay. Here's my counter question to that, though. I mean, assuming we still miss 100 million kids, we still have way more than Germany and France. So I think your point here is exactly right.
Way more what? Way more kids.
Way more kids. We still have a way big. And I think the player pool argument is ludicrous. But assuming we miss players, we still have way, way more than anybody else.
Wouldn't you rather have fewer kids who are better trained from a young age, like we're talking about?
I would, just to talk into the scouting network idea.
Mm-hmm. What about pay to play, Will? Can you briefly describe what that is and how it relates to this?
Yeah, so MLS clubs are free, except for DC United, which I don't understand their model at all. But, you know, all the other 19 MLS clubs are free. Every other club that I'm aware of in this country will charge you money to pay for them. And now this covers the coach's salary, which is almost always part-time. It covers travel, it'll cover your kits, it'll cover, you know, just the operational costs on a day-to-day basis. And this is meant not to extort money from the player. I've seen a lot of sort of overly negative stuff on pay-to-play. A lot of times these clubs need this money to survive. And a lot of them are in the Development Academy. I talked to a PDA coach not long ago, and PDA is arguably the biggest MLS club in the Development Academy, and he said they would completely go under. They would fold if they didn't have the money coming in from the kids. So, yes, absolutely, it's a barrier. You know, it's stopping some kids from playing. You know, a lot of these kids are just going back into high school because they don't have the money to play or to travel or whatever. But I do understand from one side of it, because we just wouldn't have these clubs otherwise. They would have to just completely fold, and then we'd have to reform it as something else, and who knows how long that would even take.
I mean, you get into the the dispute over DeAndre Yedlin's transfer fee and the solidarity payments in the piece. I don't think we have time to do that here, but this has been really good. What is there anything that we haven't talked about that you would add to this, either of you? I mean, there's so many things to talk about here. We could probably go on for another 2 hours, but we don't have that much time.
I do have a question for Will that I think is relevant to the listeners. Is, guys, our generation did ODP. Well, I'm curious what ODP is doing now and why it lost, why it was evolved around.
I think it's resources, honestly. I think ODP was always sort of a stopgap measure. I mean, if you look back at like the 90s teams and even early 2000s, I mean, that was it. I mean, that was how you were identified. But I remember talking to, I think it was Marcelo Balboa for a story I did a year or two ago, and he was saying how, you know, and given this was in the 90s, but how, you know, sort of dilapidated the structure was and how, you know, unprofessional the practices they did were and how they would only come together a couple times a year. And it just wasn't a very good developmental environment. And so I think it was always sort of set up to, I don't want to say fail, but just sort of falter, I guess, a little bit. And so today, you know, it's still going. They're still doing ODP championships. They're still pulling in kids. In fact, Mike Petke, the former Red Bulls coach, is now coaching ODP in New Jersey, which I think is interesting. And his point about ODP is that it can be a good supplemental development tool, but it cannot carry the torch. And I completely agree with that.
So do you see us going in the right directions, Will? I know there have been investments recently. I know U.S. Soccer has brought in, a learning guru to teach coaches how to teach, basically. What other developments can we expect to see sort of start to bear fruit, I guess, in the next couple of years?
Yeah, it's hard. You know, it's hard to say. We talk all the time about how big the country is, and I think in that way it's sort of a lumbering beast that it's hard to tell really how fast it's going until sort of we have hit sort of some watershed moment that, oh, well, we got to the semifinals of U17 World Cup and this is working. And until that happens, it'll be tough to say. But I do think, you know, as much flack as Jurgen Klinsmann's getting these days, a lot of it deserved. You know, they have done a good job at sort of starting to beef up the coaching infrastructure in terms of there's now a pro license. It's not a UEFA pro license. It's a US Soccer, USSF pro license. And so they're spinning this sort of high-end coaching where we're finally, you know, kind of getting it. And I think at the end of the day, it's going to start with the coaches and trickle down to players. And, it's, you know, if you go out to a youth game now and you look at some of these coaches coaching, they're like, okay, well, we got a long way to go. But as soon as that starts trickling down to these youth games, I think that's when you'll start seeing some of these players that are more technically inclined start to sort of fill the system. And then, you know, the gears might start moving a little bit faster.
All right. Well, Will Parchman telling us why it's all Klinsmann's fault. Thank you, Will, for coming on. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it, guys. Thanks.
Hello, this is Daryl.
And Taylor.
From the Total Soccer Show.
If you're already listening to Dummy, then you must be a smart, savvy soccer fan with excellent taste in audio.
But you should still give the Total Soccer Show a listen anyway.
Our show is a bit of everything. We've got complex breakdowns of the latest U.S. national team performances, coverage of the Premier League, the Champions League, and MLS.
We also cover up-and-coming U.S. prospects.
Shout out to Christian Pulisic.
We draft fantasy soccer rosters, the latest composed entirely of Simpsons characters.
Yeah, buddy.
And we partake in some heated trivia battles.
So give us a listen. We put out a new show 3 times a week.
You can find us on iTunes or Stitcher every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.
That's the Total Soccer Show for all your non-dummy podcast needs.
Now back to George.
Okay, Bobby, that was interesting. I want to talk now about what happens when a player refuses a club's demands. It's usually like a monetary demand or you know, it's for like bad behavior or something, but they say, yes, this player is being sent off to train by himself or train with the reserves or the youth team, and it's like an ignominious punishment for the player to absorb. They are, you know, sort of kept away from their teammates. They aren't allowed to play. Like, if you're a soccer player, all you want to do is play soccer, right? And this is like, this is like the worst thing you can do to a soccer player. It's like, I don't know. I was thinking about like some sort of animal cruelty metaphor, but that doesn't seem appropriate,
metaphor,
especially,
man.
especially with you on the line. Bobby, first of all, we're going to talk about Sam's story. Tell us what it means to be sent to play by yourself. When is this used on a player and why, and what does it mean?
There's a couple different scenarios, and mine was different than the one that Borden talks about in the article. In the article, Borden mentions a guy who had a contract dispute. And the club basically said, you must sign this new contract, you must take less wages, and if you don't, you cannot train with the team. So it was their form of coercion. For me, it was, I'm not going to say I chose it, but it was my own actions. I basically just felt that my time had run with the team. I mean, put frankly, I felt like I was physically and emotionally abused, and I just stood up for myself. And
the coach how specific can we get with your situation, Bobby?
I mean, at this point, I'll get specific.
Okay, so tell us the story.
I mean, I had been in Dallas for 2.5 years and just felt...
And you actually played a lot. You were coming off the bench, I think, for some of the games, and you started some games.
36, 35 games in 3 years.
Yeah, that's not bad, right? I mean, for a rookie and then, you know, first few seasons. And so the coach then was Shelis Hyman. Are you the one that I showed that video of him getting kicked in the balls to?
We've all seen it.
Okay.
You know, I was a good pro. I worked my ass off every day and felt like I was being shown no respect to people that were just bad professionals and bad people. There is a group of us that felt the same way. And I finally stood up, and maybe right or wrong, maybe you should never stick up to a coach. And I still think about this a lot to this day, whether I made the right action, whether it was good or bad for my career.
Was it like a public thing, or did you request like a private meeting?
Well, this is part that I'm somewhat embarrassed about. I had been in pretty much every 18 for 3 years, and we had like a road trip coming 2 days later, and I didn't make the 18. And I literally went to the assistants and the head coach, and I essentially said, screw you. These guys have no business on this 18 ahead of me. I work harder than them every day. I'm a better professional, I'm a better teammate. I'm okay with coming off the bench. These guys are openly disrespectful to you and the club. And you praise them more than me, and I'm done with this.
Are there stories that you heard in the locker rooms and stuff about players sort of like coaches like wanting a player to be that fiery and sort of, has that ever gone well, I guess, in other words? Like, do you know of examples of that? Or is it like destined to be kind of like, ooh, shouldn't do that?
No, it's a fine line. And this is ultimately why managers can make so much money or be so important. Their main job is to manage people. Mm-hmm. And they want... There was also a quote after I left, when I guess a couple months earlier, the coach had said, if I were to take 5 guys with me, these are the 5 guys. And the list was the 5 that were the most verbally abused. And all of us are like, what the hell? How could this be that he says he likes us and cherishes us the most and treats us? It's fine. Everyone leads their own way. I'm not saying that he was wrong or a bad guy in any way. It just got to the point where it's like, you can't talk to me this way and not play me. You know, I think that I'm growing as a player. I need to see what I can do. And when I basically said, you know, enough is enough, and I spoke back, which, like I said, maybe right, maybe wrong, but I spoke back, he basically said, fine, you're not welcome here anymore. For 6 weeks, I trained with the under-16s and the under-18s, unallowed in the locker room.
Did you totally boss those games?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, yeah, I don't know.
I mean, because in the story, it's interesting, the player who was sent to the reserves, like, scores 2 goals, and the assistant coach pulls him, and he's like, look, dude, you can't score that many goals. It's bad for me. It makes me look bad. Which is interesting. Yeah. Like, the politics inside a club are so opaque. We have no view in there. Players are beholden to the whim. We've talked about this before. They're like totally at the whim of the manager, because it's a completely subjective way to evaluate job performance.
But not only that, so one of my former clubs in Sweden season is starting right now. They just did the contracts 2 months ago. The first game hasn't even been played, and they asked the players of this team to take a 20% wage decrease. And I can say this because it was in the national newspapers in Sweden. And the captain of the club said, no, I just signed a new contract. You just did your wage bill. You can, like, this is your fault. I'm not going to take a 20% decrease. I already took a decrease off my last contract. This is your fault. You just laid out your budget. You messed it up, and you cannot blame me for this.
And so do you know how that played out? How has it been resolved?
They sat in that room, and apparently... they threatened him. They said, you take this or we will not play you. We will bash you with the newspapers. He said, you can go right ahead because I know the public is on my side. But it was very clear that they threatened him.
It's funny. Another example in Borden's story was the guy who had captained Ajax the season before. Right. Mm-hmm. And so in that situation, that's not like some fringe player who has no power. That's like a pretty powerful position, you know? And so the argument, I mean, I think that one of the things you sort of get the undercurrents of when you read Sam's piece is you have these club representatives sort of a little bit, you know, just saying like, well, these guys just, they're not good professionals. Like they're supposed to take it and deal with it. And that's part of being a professional soccer player.
This is a fine line. It is, right? Part of professionals taking whatever comes, but it's, you also have to stick up for yourself, right? You've got to be brave. Nobody looks out for you except you. And one of my favorite lines is, everyone's loyal until they no longer need you. So as much as you want to be a team player, as much as you want to do what the ownership and the leadership of the club is telling you is right, nobody will look out for you except for yourself. And if you don't look out for yourself, you could be on the street real fast.
So tell me about those 6 weeks training with the youth teams. I mean, and you weren't allowed in the locker room. That's kind of, that seems like an extra step, like to just sort of embarrass you, I guess. That's punishment, like overboard or something. Or what was the worst part of it? I guess I want to hear from you.
The worst part, washing my clothes every day. That part kind of sucked.
Oh, because
you know, having to like come back and throw your training gear
because the youth teams do that themselves. Like the kids do that themselves.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Because you're used to like going to the locker room, like you throw it on the floor in the basket, right? And someone does it. Yeah, it's just like demeaning, right? It's just like a way to sort of make you feel like you're not valuable to the team.
Yeah, it's just the coach, like you said, the coach can do what he wants. It's subjective and he's got the power. And it might not be good for anyone, but if it fits his ego, it's perfectly fine.
What about the role of agents here? I mean, you're under contract to this team. You can't like just go and be like, all right, well, I'm going to go.
You're opening up a can of worms here.
Yeah, I know.
A bad can of worms.
I guess objectively, you know, without getting into specifics.
MLS is the wrong place to talk about this because there's no division between MLS and agents.
Right.
Agents have a very tough time protecting players because they represent the same coaches, the same management that are sending you adrift anyway. Mm. So why would they take? I'd made $42,000. They made $2,000 on me. The coach made $350,000 under the same management.
Yeah,
they made a way bigger check off him than they did me. So why on earth would they take my side?
Right. That's interesting. Man, it's like it's so skeevy.
Don't even get me started. That's what I'm saying. You hear about all these things, and to this day, I still wonder whether I did the right thing, and I wonder if this guy in Borden's article regrets what he did. But at some point, you've got to take a stand and protect yourself.
It's funny. He at the end of the piece, he gives this quote that I thought was so. It was so interesting. It was such a simple quote, but it revealed, I thought, so much about his character and also about sort of the reality of being a soccer player. Because you don't, I don't think in any career you really get to shape your own career to the extent that we all wish was possible.
It's right? A universal concept, right? The same thing happens to people that are getting older. Age discrimination is the exact same thing.
And this guy said, you know, I thought that was going to be the best period of my career, and it ended up being the worst.
Mm-hmm.
So interesting because was he not playing in Albania? I think he had gotten out somehow, or I may be conflating two different players. But basically, he had this like perspective about it that I don't know. I just sort of envisioned him coming to this sort of Zen place about it while out by himself on some windswept soccer field.
When we watch games on TV, we often think that it's the best players that were possibly available for this team, and that there's a hierarchy and it's a meritocracy. But there's this kind of stuff that happens that we don't see. I mean, you look at it, yeah, he was released out of his contract, but he was released after the transfer window when every team had filled their spots, had filled their budget, and only out of spite. So this guy could have made a team. He could have helped the team or an organization.
Yeah.
But this little happenstance of being after the transfer window just ruined him.
Bobby, it feels to me like we've talked about this. We've talked about like the Peter Novak thing with like the hazing, the spankings and all that nonsense. But to an extent, it feels like management in soccer teams sometimes treats their employees like their kids. Like this feels like a grounding or something, you know, like when I was grounded when I was a kid for doing something bad or, you know, or like a fine, like you're not getting your allowance this week or, you know, the spanking is like probably the most obvious one. But, you know, do you think that players act immature, in some cases because the people that they're dealing with sort of treat them this way? Or do you think that the people have to treat them this way because these players are inherently kind of like big kids and not able to conduct themselves like adults?
I actually think it's the opposite of what you're saying. I think it's an interesting take and I didn't consider it, but I think it's very Machiavellian. I think it's very economic and capitalist that it's not a moral father-son relationship. It's a bottom-line relationship.
What do you mean? They needed
him to take a pay cut. They needed the roster spot. They need this and that. And it's not about punishment or not punishment. It's about a bottom line and getting what you can do to achieve that bottom line.
Well, yeah, because one thing that wasn't in the story, I don't think it was in the story, was that, think about it this way. You just made me think this. For every player that speaks up and gets sent to the reserves, maybe there are five or six who say, ooh, I better not say anything. and just take the pay cut because I don't want to be where that guy is. I don't want to be in Coconut Island. Is that what they call? Because his name was Cocos. Anyway, I mean, it must have some sort of chilling effect. Did you have any feedback from your teammates after you did that? What happened? Did players continue? I mean, I assume nobody spoke out because they're like, well, fuck that. I don't want to go play with a 16-year-old.
That's exactly right, man. I was not the only one to feel what I felt. And they felt simultaneously proud of me, but bad for me, and use it as a lesson. You know, I got a lot of texts saying, hey, man, we miss you. Hey, we're making sure nobody takes your locker. You know, sorry about what happened. And they were proud that I stood up for myself. They were proud that somebody finally said something. But they obviously didn't do the same thing. You know, they used it as a warning sign or
you're like an example. And yeah. Huh. And especially, you know, yours wasn't even a case where they were trying to get people to take wage cuts, but,
mine was somewhat self-inflicted, and it's tough to compare the two. We both had a similar experience.
I wouldn't be embarrassed. I would not be embarrassed if I were you. I think that you stood up for yourself. I think that's admirable. I mean, you have to make choices like that. And you know, I think it's more admirable to make a choice, even if you in retrospect think it might have been the wrong one, than to just have sat by and think I took shit that I shouldn't have taken.
It seems to be a ubiquitous concept that everyone in their work environment and their professional life has this issue. That mine was with a coach, but everyone has this issue with their boss, what they don't get along with, or they feel abused or feel it's a block in their career path.
That's interesting. Have you felt recent, like since then, that you wanted to say something and you've had sort of second thoughts because of that experience, or how has that worked out?
I'm the opposite now. Because I was a little bit of an abused puppy for a few years, going back to the horrible animal reference, that I take no shit from no one now. That because what I found is that the only thing that made me feel worse than saying something was saying nothing. So at this point, I have no problem. This part of growing up, too, and being able to have grown-up conversations, I think this is the important part of maturing.
How old were you then, Bobby?
23. Yeah. When it happened, 24.
You're pretty young.
So it wasn't, you know, in adult terms, I was young. But now I have no problem knocking on a person's door and having an honest conversation saying, I feel you're treating, not just myself, I say for other teammates more than, probably
but
more
you, you've also should. Been, you were also the captain when you were playing in Norway?
Yes. Not the guy with the armband, but one of the three or four.
Okay. And I don't know if you're the captain now with Harrisburg. You are. Okay. And so you have now a position of like recognized authority, and that probably helps to bring issues to the coach, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you have to be in that position. Maybe in Dallas, I wasn't in that position, but I'm very much in anything. You know, if I feel, I think part of this is helping me play better too, because now I don't think twice. In Dallas, I always feel like a pent up dog who had all this aggression, but I couldn't let it out, worried about what happened. Now, if I'm playing 6v6 and somebody says something wrong or I get fouled and it's not called, I have no problem standing up and saying and just freaking out. But I think overall it makes me feel better. I'm 100% in.
I'm really glad I haven't pushed you to that point yet on the podcast.
Yeah, and it's totally embarrassing at times. But like I said, the only thing worse than feeling bad about doing something is feeling bad about not doing anything.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder if anyone who's listening to this has had any experience like this. I'd be curious, but
I think everyone has, George. I think this is a totally human experience of when to say something, when not to, when to stick up for yourself, when shouldn't you? Because I think we've all made mistakes in our lives where we should have stuck up for ourselves. We should have just kept our mouths shut and been a good soldier waiting for a new opportunity.
Yeah. All right, Bobby, I want to end it there. Thank you for sharing. I know that was very personal and I appreciate it. I feel like one of the great things about having you on the podcast and Danny before you is that we get this perspective from people who have been in these spots that we read about and get to talk to some thoughtful guys about it. So thank you.
Thanks, man. I think it was an important conversation to have.
All right, Bobby, very quickly, because I have to go to the, I think 10th annual Gasparilla Film Festival here in Tampa. Let's do Tiki Taka. What is your Tiki Taka?
My Tiki Taka goes back to the conversation with Will about U.S. youth soccer development. And there's a question we need to ask ourselves before we progress. Obviously, we don't really have a say in this, but it's whether we really want to take the leaps that we need to. Whether we want kids in order to progress as far as they can in soccer, it means that they probably have to miss out on homecoming, miss out on prom, miss out on playing high school basketball, high school football, miss out on going to the movies with their friends, miss out on college more than likely. So we have to ask ourselves a moral question before we ask a soccer question.
Do you have buddies that, do you guys talk about this as like
Yeah, most of my friends that came up through the U.S. soccer system and played college think it's nuts that we make kids miss their prom and not play high school baseball and not go to college. Totally not worth it. You guys, I've been professional for 6 years, and the chances of you looking back and saying, oh, wow, this was better than going to college are very slim.
Interesting. I mean, you did go to college. Do you feel like you were able to make the most of Stanford, or do you feel like you didn't have the chance to really be a college student?
Made the most of it. College was awesome. And this is my personal moral stance. Maybe 99% of people disagree, and that's as a soccer society or as individuals, we need to make that choice.
You know, when I was in college, though, I got roomed just totally randomly with a guy, also from Pennsylvania, very good player. He turned out to be a 4-year starter on the soccer team. Oh, cool. And I had quit my senior year of high school. I was just like, I'm done with this. And what I saw from him was like, he was super disciplined, went to bed at like 10 PM every night, which sucked for me. he was like, watched what he ate. He couldn't take classes in the afternoon because he had to go to training. And, you know, I don't know if he regrets it or not, but I saw it and I was like, you know what? I am sure glad that I am not doing that just to sit on the bench of the Yale.
Where do you
men's
stand on
soccer
the issue? Do you think that we should push kids away from college, push them away from all these activities of growing up?
I think it has to be personal choice, but I also think that adults have an outsized role in setting expectations for kids because they're kids. And I don't have a good answer for that. I think this is something we should look into more. And if only we had like a soccer magazine, we could ask someone to write a story about it. Maybe we will. Okay, Bobby, my Tiki Taka really briefly is the story in the New York Daily News. It's about the U.S. women's national team, and it's called Soccer Wars. The deck is, as the women of the U.S. national team fight for equality in their sport, the Daily Dig discovers that the discriminatory treatment they've been subjected to is not merely unfair, but quite possibly illegal. It's really long. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that, I'm very impressed by the depth of the reporting and sort of the argument that this writer, Elizabeth Mitchell, makes in the Daily News, not a paper known for its soccer coverage. And it's just a really good look at where we are right now in social, political, and economic terms with the way we recognize and reward and cultivate the women's soccer players in this country. And it's just a fascinating read. So we will have a link to that on our show page. I don't want to get too much into it because I think there are better venues for that, but that is my Tiki Talk. You should go and read this. It's fascinating.
George, we should say one thing that we've pondered too is having conversations where we discuss the morality of this instead of we really just go on and have a 20-minute conversation on the pros and cons of these things. And if that's something
we should
want to hear,
let's do it. Yeah.
Just hit us up on Twitter.
All right. That's a good segue. I want to thank our guest today, Will Parchman. Of course, Bobby. Bobby is playing with the Harrisburg City Islanders. So if you don't have a team and you want to pick a team, make that your team. That's my new team. I'm very psyched for you guys. I'm bummed I'm not going to be here when you guys come to Orlando. I'm really bummed. But thank you to Bobby. Thank you to our producers. We have so many producers. We have Wes Burdine. We have Nick Jansen. We have Faisal Sikdar. We have a brand new producer named Chrissy Pease, who I'm very excited about. She works for Minnesota Public Radio. And
love those public radio people.
Yeah.
So good.
Hell yeah. Let's see. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We are at What a Howler. Go to Facebook. Give us a like. All of this stuff helps. I know I say it, but it helps. If you go to iTunes and leave a review or leave a rating, it actually helps. Like, people find it and they start listening to it, and it helps us grow our audience. And that's really the only way we can decide whether or not you guys are liking what we're doing. So please do. It means a lot. For Bobby, my name is George Qureshi. I want to remind you that when you listen to Dummy, you will never listen alone.